Welcome to Take It From Us with host Kent Johns. Real people, real voices, real lives. Discussing mental health, addiction, and disability in the community. Your weekly window to the real world. Welcome to Take It From Us.
Our guest today is Tammy Harris, who is the Chief Executive of Acorn Diversity, established in 2018 to empower neurodivergent children and youth by giving them the tools they need to reach their potential. Tammy speaks passionately about the struggles we have in Aotearoa to adequately help those with autism and ADHD. She has a neurodivergent son and speaks of the frustrations and disillusionment her family has gone through over the years. Tammy is fiercely determined to make changes to the way we support people with neurodiversity, but knows patience is a virtue too. Change takes time. She's eloquent and engaging. I really enjoyed our conversation. I hope you do as well. Tammy, it's lovely to have you on Take It From Us. I've been looking forward to having a chat to hear about your own experience with neurodiversity. We'll talk about your son, but also you've been working in this field for about 30 years or so. How did you arrive in New Zealand many years ago?
On a plane, that was my waka. But I basically, we had an opportunity to move from Los Angeles to Queenstown. Who wouldn't take that up for my husband's work? And we thought, oh, it'd be a great place for the kids, and the education's supposed to be really awesome. So we landed in 2012, down in the South Island, and then moved up to Auckland about 2017, mainly looking for other kind of resources for our youngest child who is neurodivergent.
Mm. And how has that journey been for you? Because I think he's 16 years old now.
Yeah, he's getting up there, and he's doing really well, but it has been an absolute journey. And I think, a journey not so much because of who he is, but more of a journey because of what the system is around him. And that it's sort of like fitting a square peg into a round hole. It just, doesn't work. So from the get-go, we found it really challenging in New Zealand to find those services that he needed. When we left Los Angeles, he was in a speech and language preschool program. He was about three, that was 20 hours a week, fully funded by Department of Education, because they recognize that, you know, if you provide supports when kids are young, they won't need so much later. So he was in that program 20 hours a week. And then we moved to New Zealand, assuming that it would all be the same here, because New Zealand was, you know, so progressive in the education. So we were a bit shocked when we got here and went to try and figure out how to get him assessed for speech services, basically, because his speech was quite delayed. And I work in the field. I'm a professional. I generally have a good sense of how these kind of systems work for my own work. And it took me forever to figure out, who do we contact? How do we get work through this to try and get him some support? And when I finally got through and he had a little speech and language assessment through the Ministry of Ed, he qualified for 30 minutes of speech every 3 weeks for a three-year-old, which, you know, what's that going to do? It should be relationship-based. And, you know, a three-year-old is not going to be able to form much of a relationship with somebody they see every 3 weeks for 30 minutes, let alone actually gaining any skills, in development in his speech and language. And we're in a very fortunate position that we were privileged enough to be able to afford private speech therapy. But we know that the majority of people out there can't. We basically made our own plans about kind of what we thought he needed. And again, because that is my professional background, that was a privilege as well, that we kind of knew what would be helpful and what he might need. But we also found just a lack of general resources for the things that we would take for granted, just weren't available. They didn't exist. The professionals themselves and the knowledge, didn't exist.
And then what happened when he was old enough to go to school? What sort of support did you get then?
So he transitioned from a wonderful Montessori preschool, or kindy, into, year one. And it was very wrecky. So he wasn't a kid who is really great at sitting in a seat for long periods of time. And, you know, the expectations really ramp up when you hit year one compared to, you know, early childhood. And he also, I think, was just really overwhelmed with the expectations that he just didn't have the skills to meet yet. And so that ability to pay attention, sit in one place, manage his body, and, you know, find interest in the things that were going on, it just wasn't his thing. And so he did a lot of, you know, there was a lot of challenging behavior that was very difficult for the teacher. And, you know, it's one teacher with 25 little squirrely five-year-olds. It's pretty hard being a new entrance teacher, especially when you've got kids who do require a lot more of your attention and support. And it wasn't enough for him. His needs were more significant and he just wasn't able to stay emotionally regulated and would have kind of huge outbursts that were scary and horrible for everybody involved, but mostly I think for him because it just happened, right? He was only five. And then there would be, you know, disciplinary action and me being called in and, you know, alert, emergency. And it was just so frustrating because that just happens over and over and over without any additional resources being brought in. So it just felt like we as parents were the only ones who were being asked to provide resources. So it was sort of, you know, our problem that he's not receiving an education and it was too hard and therefore it wasn't their problem. And I just coming from a, you know, a place where that is highly illegal, you know, where every child is legally supposed to have a full-time education and the resources have to be provided to enable that education, to a system where if they don't have the resources, they just tell the kid to go home. Very different system that was, very shocking to us.
Was your son frustrated and disheartened because he was misunderstood? Was he scared? Was it a combination of all of those things?
Yeah, I think it was probably both of those things, Kent. I think it was just too much. And I think kids also have a sense, you know, early on that they're failing. You know, I mean, when you're constantly, your name is constantly being called and it's not in a positive way. After a while, you feel sort of powerless. You feel poorly about yourself. And then it just starts that negative cycle of, oh, whatever, I'm the naughty kid. And I don't know what I need to do here. Nobody's giving me that sort of support I need to learn how to do whatever it is that's expected, that he couldn't cope. And, you know, we felt horrible, of course, because we knew it was a huge challenge for the school and for the teacher. And we're completely empathetic to what they were experiencing and the other kids. It's really not fair to anybody involved when a child who has higher needs isn't having their needs met. It really does affect everyone around them.
Yeah, so clearly you're really empathetic to both sides here, which is probably more than maybe a lot of parents would be given how frustrating and aggravating and upsetting this can be. So you're able to see it from both sides. How did that affect you and your husband?
A lot of guilt, let's just say. I mean, it was, honestly, I remember sitting through school meetings with, you know, six other adults and various, you know, the learning support coordinator and the deputy principal and the teacher's aide and the teacher and, you know, blah, blah. And I do those kind of meetings every day, all the time for kids that I work with and in my professional life. So I've been to a lot of those meetings, but now for myself. And so to be in a room where they're going around the table and every single person is saying something negative, really negative about your child, to sit there and listen to that and listen to them not being able to offer up anything. I mean, it's one thing to go around and say, okay, these are the things we're identifying and here's what we're going to do. But it only went with here's the things we're identifying and we don't know what to do. And that's not what you want to hear from your teaching team. I don't want them all turning to me as the parent saying, okay, so what are you going to do? I'm not at school. I mean, I have lots of ideas about what I would do, but unfortunately those things aren't happening and aren't able to happen then. And so I remember sitting in those meetings like crying because it's such an assault and it's such a, you feel like such a failure as a parent. And I know what this is doing to the people in the room as well. You know, I completely see their point of view. It is really difficult. And they feel also like they're not doing the right thing and they're, you know, not failing maybe, but they also, I know they wish they could do more, but everybody's sort of bound by the restrictions in the system. They're just, isn't what they need is not there, which is, yeah, just heartbreaking for everybody.
So this was a decade or so ago.
Yeah.
With the teachers and the principals and other people in the room coming from just a place of ignorance, or was there some willful ignorance in there as well?
That's a good question. I think definitely there is some ignorance, and definitely working in the community then in the child and mental health space, where I was working professionally, I, you know, was going into all the local schools and could see lots of children who were clearly on the autism spectrum or clearly ADHD or learning disabilities who had never actually been identified. And they were just called naughty, right? Naughty, bad, stupid. And so I felt like just sort of across the board, there was, you know, sort of general lack of understanding and knowledge about neurodivergence and about different learning needs. And that, again, I understood that this wasn't part of teacher training, wasn't part of their experience. And if you're coming from a lens like you and I are, Kent, of, you know, growing up in the 80s or whatever, kids were seen in a very different way and things were really all about like you just punish it out of them or they get out. And so it sort of felt like we were still kind of in that world here and there just weren't really any other resources. So I felt like people wanted to do the right thing and they wanted to support us, but they just really didn't, like you said, they just really didn't know what to do. What are the things that you do in a case like this? And I, as a professional, could probably have come in and, you know, suggested quite a lot of things, as I was doing in my work and as we do at Acorn. But I was in the parent position then. And so it's very different. You're definitely not seen as the expert when you're the parent, which is very humbling and frustrating. And that's something that we're always trying to remind people is that the parents are the experts. They know their child. They probably have a pretty good idea of what they need. But yeah, it's a really tough spot to be in.
So what's changed in the last, you're referencing the 80s, and I was a child of the 80s, and I remember my school life very, very fondly. And I didn't even hear the term neurodiversity. We didn't know what that was. How have things changed in the last 40 years? And are we just having more conversations that our awareness is so high relative to the number of diagnosed cases? Or has our environment changed in that time so that we're actually seeing more children now being diagnosed?
Well, it's a little bit of both of those things. I mean, I think definitely awareness has grown from when you and I were kids. There's more knowledge. There's more science, research, so on. People are better at identifying it. But I think, you know, also some of that varies by country. And I saw that hugely when I moved here, you know, from the U.S., just that, you know, we were in New Zealand about 20 years behind where we were at the things that we were doing to support these kids in the U.S. at the time. And so I think there's sort of a slow trickle out of all this new knowledge and information. And so it may indeed be that there are, in fact, more kids. I think the jury's still out on that. This is a debate constantly in the community, right, of professionals and researchers is, are there actually more people? Or is it that we've really gotten much better at identifying and also that the categories are broader now than they were, and a little bit less medicalized. So I think that does contribute that perhaps more people are being identified who in our time definitely would not have been identified at all, because they could, quote, you know, kind of pass for normal, quote unquote. So I think it's a combination of both, that maybe there are, in fact, more people. Maybe there are environmental things going on that are changing us and sort of that epigenetics that we know about now are being activated. Or maybe we're just getting better at identifying. And I think, you know, the term neurodiversity and neurodivergence are still very new terms, you know, and they're kind of, you know, cool and trendy at the moment. Who knows what will be next? But I think also they're tossed around a lot, you know, even by sort of youth culture, that, you know, in some areas, they're kind of, it's kind of cool to be quirky and different, and people are kind of self-diagnosing, which isn't necessarily accurate either. So I think it's, yeah, it's a weird time in terms of that. Who really is, and how do you determine what the need is, the real need? And particularly when you're thinking of like government systems, obviously they want to be only addressing the need, not a bunch of other stuff that, you know, they don't have to, you know, they will be okay. And so it's really looking at, so how do we identify the kids who do have real, you know, developmental delays, challenges, actual disabilities or challenges that need, that really need that learning support. And so how do we identify them? And then how do we make sure they get the resources that they need early on?
Yeah, and there's a spectrum involved too, right? Where there are mild symptoms, moderate, and all of the rest of it. So you, I guess you could have someone, let's say hypothetically, who has displays mild symptoms for ADHD, who may not necessarily need a hell of a lot of wraparound care and support, as opposed to someone who's at the other end.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. So I think it's always going to be that way. And, you know, we can all, you know, you may have friends who are now getting diagnosed as adults, right? I know a whole bunch of women.
Plenty.
Yeah, who are, have suddenly gotten diagnoses for ADHD, and it makes their whole history make sense. They're suddenly like having this great like validation of like, oh, all those struggles, like, oh, I get it now. You know, I understand myself better, which is great. But in terms of schooling, you know, I would say if we can only focus on some of the kids in need, we need to focus on the ones with the higher needs, and the, you know, the people who are going to benefit from the resources that we have. And I do think, I mean, the way our system, the education system is structured for learning support, and I don't think, despite the budget, the new budget, I don't think it's going to change very much. You know, only 1% of kids receive ongoing resourcing for learning support. So that's the ORS scheme, ongoing resource scheme. Only 1% of kids receive that, which means there's only 1% of the, you know, let's say 15 at least percent of kids that we know have some kind of learning challenge, that are getting ongoing support. And the rest is all just a, you know, pick a mix of, you know, maybe you'll get our TLB for 10 weeks, and maybe we'll, you know, you'll have a reader writer for your assessments in high school, and maybe, you know, just sort of here and there, little bits of support, or the school funds a teacher's aide, but they only have that teacher aide 2 hours a day. And so there's that cohort of kids, you know, sort of another 14% of kids who aren't getting the support that they need. And those are the ones I think we lose, that we kind of throw away, like my son, for instance, who end up out of school because the school doesn't meet their needs and they're not getting what they need to meet those needs to keep them engaged in school.
So here's the big question then. Does there need to be legislation passed where it is now, we're going to make sure that every school has a certain number of teacher aides, as opposed to that being driven by the school as a core value? And I know my primary school, where my kids go, they have value, they value their teacher aides. They put a lot of resource, a lot of time into bringing up the number. My kids know all of the teacher aides at school. They know which children are requiring assistance. And it's something I think that the school is proud of. But I also am aware that not every school would adopt that kind of mentality. So do we need to have broad legislation to force schools for this stuff? Or do we let them organically arrive at the conclusion that it's got to be self-driven?
Ooh, well, I'm probably going to say some things that aren't very popular here in response to that.
No.
So, yeah, I mean, I think that is, you just nailed it. That is a huge, huge problem that our legislation currently, the Education and Training Act, is leaves a lot of wiggle room. You know, sure, it says every kid has the right to full-time education, but that is, there's no accountability. There's nothing behind that. And there's nothing that says that kids with, you know, disabilities or learning differences need to be taught in the way that they require, right? So there's nothing that says that schools have to provide support. And then the real issue, I think, is the self-governing school model. So we know each school is governed by its own board, and the Ministry of Ed can't actually really direct that board. It's set up in such a way that there isn't really a higher power. So if a school, you know, unlike your primary school, if their values do not involve inclusion, and that's not how they want to spend their discretionary funding, then they will just say, I'm sorry, we can't have your child. And that somehow is okay. So we work with at Acorn about 225 families in direct service a year. And of those, at least a quarter are only allowed to attend school 2 hours a day, because that's all that the school can provide of teacher aid time. And it's a child who needs to have a teacher's aid. So we know already if they're not able to be in class without a teacher's aid, that they have a pretty high level of need. And so clearly, to me, it's a human rights issue. They're being sent home after 2 hours. That means a parent has to quit working. They have to be home with a child who probably requires a lot of care, which means that person's life is highly restricted during school hours, and the child's not learning, most of all. And so, again, that comes down to that individual school can make those decisions, which I totally understand. They don't have the resources. So I think, to your point, it'd be great if there was sort of a higher power. And I think that's the only thing that's going to change it, is something coming down from the top saying you have to take every child in your zone regardless. And we will resource you, though, for those kids. I think that's what, in order for it to work, if you're going to say schools have to take every kid, which I think they should, then the government needs to provide those resources. Otherwise, it's, you know, schools are caught in that position, and a lot will just say, no, you can't come to our school. You're basically too expensive. Or schools like yours will do wonderful things to accommodate and support and include, but then they end up being a magnet for those kids. I mean, we know we've got lots of, we sort of know the schools. Ooh. In Auckland region, kind of, you know, and then that happens. And so it's really, and it's a horrible spot for parents then, because, I mean, if your kid gets excluded from a school because they have a disability, basically, and they have more challenging needs than the school can manage, it's possible that they won't get picked up by another school, that all the schools will say, no, no, thank you, no, thank you. And then what? And so we've got all these kids who've been home for, in fact, I was just talking with a parent earlier as a child who's been out of school a full year, and they won't have a placement for him for a full one more year. So this is a kid out of school 2 years with fairly significant needs that are not being met, and a family that is falling apart because they're not getting any, they're with the child 24/7 and can't work. And I mean, it just, the ripple effect is huge.
While we've got you here, wanted to ask you too about neuroinclusivity in the workplace.
Oh yeah.
Right. What would you score New Zealand 1 to 10 in this regard? Give us a raw number.
Oh gosh, I don't know. I mean, I think if we're carrying on from schools, you know, I think it's the people who arrive at work, obviously are able to get in the door, right, to the job, which is fantastic, right? That's a big tick for employers, organizations, and the people themselves. I think it's once they get in the door, then what kind of supports are being offered, and is the employee, the neurodivergent employee, comfortable, or in a situation where they can just say, hey, would you mind if I, instead of working in the big open plan space, I went over in the, you know, the little conference room to work today because the noise is getting to me. So it's like if employers are creating, things like that, that any employee can access. So it's not a stigma. It's not a special thing that somebody needs. I think they're going to get a plus. But I think a lot of employers are still kind of where our schools are and not really recognizing that people work in different ways. People are at their best in kind of different situations. And if you're bringing somebody onto the team, you want them to be at their best. And so what can we do to help each person work to their best? And for the most part, the, you know, sort of adjustments that you might offer to a, you know, autistic person, ADHD person, whatever, are probably going to end up benefiting a lot of the employees, not just the neurodivergent employees, because, well, let's face it, we're all different. And so I think the more we can have that thinking in workspaces, the better really it supports all employees, not just the neurodivergent ones. But I think at this point, there really isn't that, you know, we're still in a learning process, getting there.
Yeah. And then it comes to assessments as well. And we know ADHD, particularly for young women, you can go years without being diagnosed. You can go years without being able to even find an appointment.
Yeah.
To have a diagnosis, are we making inroads in that regard?
Definitely making inroads, and ADHD New Zealand has been fantastic in really facilitating an easier process across the board. And we're offering ADHD assessments now for kids and adults, which, you know, I think more people will start hopefully being able to provide. But it is still really difficult because, again, going back to education, if our teachers aren't trained a little bit, at least about ADHD and how it presents, they're not going to pick it up. And same with autism. A lot of girls we know present, they're not necessarily as hyperactive, impulsive, as, you know, the boys are. And so often they don't get noticed, and parents might just hear things like, oh, Susie's not living up to her potential, or, oh, she's away with the fairies, or, oh, you know, she's lazy. And these, to me, whenever I hear any of those words, I think, aha, it's probably inattentive ADHD that hasn't been identified. And so part of it's we need to educate educators, again, to notice sooner so girls can get support. And then, yes, there needs to be more readily available assessment services.
So you're the chief executive at Acorn Neurodiversity. You've got quite the large team there, eh?
Yeah. We've got an amazing team. And we're really, really focused on providing kind of evidence-based support so that everyone is, you know, qualified professional in their discipline, and we can really work together across disciplines to support families so that hopefully when a family comes to Acorn, you know, if they need speech therapy, occupational therapy, positive behavior support, mental health care, whatever they need, it's all there, so that they have that sense of kind of wraparound support, because it really doesn't exist out there. Everything is very siloed, and very difficult to get kind of integrated support, which we know is what makes ultimately the difference.
And how are you able to support those people or those families that have younger people who are autistic or they may have fetal alcohol spectrum disorder?
Yeah, so the services that we provide would be, you know, are usually kind of what families are looking for in terms of if they've got an autistic or FASD child or ADHD child, and they're really struggling with emotional regulation, or some of our autistic kids are, you know, working on speech and language, or they've got, you know, sensory processing differences that make the environment really overwhelming. Those are the sort of things that we can really support with and get behind the family, and as well work with their schools, so that schools are better able to recognize what's going on and support them too.
Well, I'd be right in thinking for yourself and your team and also getting this across to the families that it's that really... The sheer force, the two competing forces of patience and persistence. Yes. Would that be right?
You're good, Kent. Yep. Yeah. Patience and persistence. Yes. The P's definitely pay off. And yeah. And it's definitely, you know, I think development is not a straight line.
It's never linear, is it?
Linear, exactly. And so, you know, it's like you're going along and things are going great. And then we'll be like, oh, bump in the road. And then hopefully you can reach out for support. And then you get over that bump. And then hopefully you get another smooth ride for a while. And then it's the next, you know, kind of developmental phase. And so we really want to be on that, you know, on the journey with families to kind of support them over those bumps. But yes, persistence and patience, and really trying to understand your child and what's cool about them and, you know, sort of maximize those things.
Another P would be paradox, right? We're wanting to change and we need to raise awareness. We need to push and we need to ask questions. We need to be more curious and all the rest of it. But we also at the same time have to realize the system is troubled and it's entrenched and it is going to take a long time to unpick some stitching. So how do you reconcile that as someone with a lot of energy and purpose?
Well, it is frustrating. And I just feel like, you know, I think everyone's probably sick and tired of me banging on and on about the same things in the system. But I think that's what we need to keep doing, particularly as parents, just telling our stories and making people aware. Because I find that if you don't have a child who's neurodivergent or has extra needs, or you don't work in that space, you probably have no idea, what's going on. I've had lots of friends say to me like, oh, all those kids are taken care of. I'm like, what are you talking about? You have no idea. They're not taken care of at all. So I think it's really just like this opportunity, Kent is helping more people be aware and talk to, you know, people who may be in positions of power to change systems. But yeah, it's slow going.
Yeah, I hear you. And I was having a conversation with a couple of parents a little while ago, and they were really sympathetic to teachers now,
yeah,
who are having to manage a classroom, as you said, 25, maybe sometimes 30 young kids running around. And how are our teachers supposed to be able to cater for all of these different individual needs? But I kind of pointed out, hey, look, on the flip side, what if you were a parent of a child with neurodiversity? You wouldn't want your kid to fall through the cracks. Like, we actually do have to aspire, and we can, and it's great to hear someone like yourself so empathetic towards the position that teachers find themselves in. But we also have to be aspirational, don't we? And
yeah,
and get us all to the point where there is a greater level of tolerance, curiosity, understanding, and empathy.
Oh, love that. Yes, exactly. That would be amazing.
How's your son now?
He's good. He's a teenager, so you know.
I remember those years.
But yes, exactly. We're almost out, but yes, still trucking on through. So he is good. He has come so far, and we're so proud of him. He's a hard worker, and he talk about having to be persistent. He is without a doubt the most tenacious, just resilient person I've ever known. Given his journey, just his resilience, we know that he'll be fine, because he will just keep on pushing through, which is amazing quality.
I'll tell you something that always brings a smile to my face is when, and I know lots of people with ADHD, and a lot of them have been diagnosed late, but they often now talk about it as a superpower, and they smile about it, and they give a little fist pump like, yes, man, I'm different, and I know I'm different. But that's cool, because I can do things that I would not be able to do if I didn't have the ADHD. Is that how your son looks at life?
I don't know that he has, you know, he's not that self-aware, you know, maybe at some point. And I think...
Well, he's a young teenage boy, right?
Exactly. Like, enough said, right?
Yeah.
He is, in fact, just a teenager. But hopefully at some point he will see those things. You know, he'll see how some of his challenges can also be strengths. And I think, I mean, the superpower thing always makes me a little bit uncomfortable, because for a lot of people,
it's not.
They're not feeling the superpower part. But I think what you're touching on is just how important it is for identity to know who you are and know this about yourself, that you're not bad, you're not naughty, you're not stupid. This is ADHD, and sometimes it presents challenges, and it makes life a bit harder, right, to work through some of those things. And that is the superpower, right? That resilience, that tenacity of just keeping on pushing through and learning those things and meeting those challenges. That is like the superpower.
Big journey for mom and dad though, eh?
Yeah. Yeah, I'll say. Definitely everyone has to be tenacious and resilient.
Hey, Tammy, it's been awesome having you on. What are you most hopeful for?
Oh, I'm just really hopeful that our kids, the great things about them will be seen at school, and that they'll be able to stay in education and be able to learn the things that they need to learn, which might be different from what other kids need to learn. But yeah, I'm really hopeful that we continue as a country to grow and understand and support all of vulnerable people who need that.
Thanks so much for your time. Thanks for sharing your wisdom and your knowledge, but also your own lived experience with this, and go well.
Thank you. You too, Kent. It's been a pleasure.
Take It From Us is produced by Karen Murphy, and I am your host, Kent Johns. Please get in touch with us on Facebook. We'd love to hear from you.
You're listening to Take It From Us. My story, your story, our story. A whole world of radio on planetaudio.org.nz.
Senior Focus is a reflective radio program designed for those 50 plus, where you can listen to a wealth of knowledge and expertise and insights coming from within our senior community. Our range of topics and guests stretching from the personal to the professional, from advocates to inventors and heritage buffs, will offer unique perspectives. Our senior focus program is on at 5:25 p.m. on Sundays. Or listen online at any time at planetaudio.org.nz/senior focus.
The Sports Weekender features interviews with sports people and commentators, local and national sports updates, and a roundup of the latest from the world of sports. I'm your host, Piggy. You can join me for 2 hours every Saturday from 9:40 a.m. on Planet 104.6 FM or listen online on planetaudio.org.nz/sportsweekender.
In Auckland, just about everywhere, you can see the water, and it has a lovely calming and invigorating effect.
Next to the ocean, wide open sea, cool breeze, lot of open space.
Hiking, swimming, lovely beaches.
Beaches.
I love the West Coast. I love being able to get in my car and in 40 minutes being in one of the most beautiful beaches in the world.
Loving Auckland.
Well, I love that it's such a green city. It's just so rich in texture with all the different plants and trees and shrubs. There are giant trees, more than 150 years old. You can touch the roots of the country, of the history.
I love the bush, the heaps of parks around Auckland that you can go and play in, and the libraries.
Loving Auckland, our diverse city. 104.6 Planet FM.
Take It From Us brings you real stories from real people, sharing their experiences of mental distress and journeys to recovery. Tune in next Tuesday at 12:30 p.m. right here on 104.6 Planet FM, or catch the latest episodes at planetaudio.org.nz/takeitfromus. It's a half hour of commercial-free music coming up next now here on Planet FM, taking us through to Samlyn Khmer with news, music and updates from Cambodia on air at 10 past 2.
I want to tell you, you are the reason, reason for everything. Don't know if I told you, but you give me reason, purpose for everything. And I'm letting you know right now, someday, somehow, I'll pay it all back, all back, all back. I'll pay it all back, all back, all back.
I dream so, and my dream so. I don't wanna come down, I'm sick, they ain't even run down. You're the only one that makes me come round when I'm going off like gum rounds. Make a mum proud that her son found a real one to hold her son down. And I'm dumbfounded how far we've come, back where we started from. Young kings and bare feet, back where we started from. Gonna be a long summer, not getting any younger. Since Mega Drive, since Royal Rumbles on a trampoline with my brothers. Won't hesitate to throw hands for on everything that we stand for. Just wanted to climb that tree and got a little more than we planned for. But hey, even if it's empty bleachers, shout out those who would never leave us. No cute cards, just true love, no acceptance speeches.
I wanna tell you, you are the reason, reason for everything. Don't know if I told you. Purpose for everything. And I'm letting you know right now, someday, somehow, I'll pay it all back, all back, all back. I'll pay it all back, all back, all back.
Say things that aren't true, one thing that I can't do. Their dad's a dreamer, and I hope one day that they are too. And it's true that sometimes you do a bad thing for a good reason. Shouts to the boys who be on your doorstep and stand flat if we need. I feel invincible with these men, invincible with this pen. Think we got more power than we know, and all these messages that we send. And I can't pretend I don't want more. Never let complacency be my downfall. Never really felt at home until now. Shit to do if you're still down. And it's human nature to get gassed up and just say stuff. Got a 1B5 and it's full of stuff, I don't say enough. And if ever that day comes when we can truly say that we made it, just dream sell, gonna be one hell of a tale to tell when we're fading.
I wanna tell you, you are the reason, reason for everything. Don't know if I told you, but you give me reason, purpose for everything. And I'm letting you know right now, someday, somehow,
is for everything.